I don't believe that threats and intimidation are a good way to win over friends and gain support.
After a dramatic healthcare vote, Senator Lisa Murkowski talks about the way forward. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 31st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a legal controversy over a whale harvest in Neposkiak.
This is our food.
This is ours.
Okay? It's not slaughtering nothing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Less than 24 hours after her tie-breaking vote on health care, Senator Lisa Murkowski was in Alaska this weekend, where she sat down with local reporters for her first in-depth interview. Murkowski told KCAW's Emily Kwong that the bill on the floor wasn't ready for a vote and left Alaskans in the dark about their health insurance.
If Senator Lisa Murkowski is in the eye of a political power struggle over health care, you wouldn't know it. The vote ended after 2 a.m. She was on a plane to Sitka at 8 a.m. to do some pretty standard Sitka things. Tour Mount Edgecombe Hospital, meet with local leaders, and go fishing with her son.
I'm happy. And then I have to go back to D.C.
Back to D.C., where her no vote on Thursday helped kill a Republican-led effort to overturn the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. She agrees with President Donald Trump that the law is flawed.
We still have high costs, high premiums. We still have limited access.
But she thinks there are parts of Obamacare worth saving, particularly around Medicaid. And in explaining her vote, she focused her criticism on process, on the Senate repealing Obamacare without a replacement and writing policies behind closed doors. After she voted against advancing the so-called skinny repeal, Trump tweeted Wednesday morning that she let the country down and called her on the phone.
The president and I had a very hard phone call.
How do you stand that pressure, though? The president of the United States calls you and wants a piece of partisan legislation to go through.
You know, there's a lot at stake, certainly with healthcare, where so much is personal to so many. And when you know that people are counting on you to be their voice, it really does cause you to stand up a little bit straighter and maybe have a little bit more backbone to just say, I know everybody is saying this, but I need you to hear this.
Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke also placed a call to both Murkowski and Senator Dan Sullivan.
I do not believe that Secretary Zinke was being threatening or intimidating. He was just delivering a message that the president was not happy with my vote.
As for the reports from the Alaska Dispatch News that the president would hamper Alaska's energy development as a slap on the wrist for her vote, Murkowski had this to say.
I don't believe that threats and intimidation are a good way to win over friends and gain support.
With the Republican Party moving right of center, Murkowski's moderate voice is standing out. She wants any future health care reform to happen in committee, with public hearings and participation from both sides of the aisle. Senators Susan Collins of Maine and John McCain of Arizona seem to agree. Before voting, she says McCain told her on the Senate floor, Lisa, do what you know is right.
And it reminded me of the old Ted Stevens phrase that he would use. He would say, to hell with politics, just do what's right for Alaska.
Which, for Murkowski, means that Obamacare is something to be reformed. She's singing a different tune than she did in 2015 when she voted for outright repeal. But doing so now, when Alaska has only one health insurance provider, she says would be detrimental. Moving forward, she had choice words for her fellow senators about letting the president control the conversation.
You can just kind of say, well, it's going to be a tough day and don't know how we're going to get anything done. Or the Senate, the House, the Congress, which is that separate but equal legislative branch of government, can stand up, get its act together, And push back.
And to push back not just on healthcare, but on every issue that comes to the floor. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
In southwest Alaska, a tired crew of volunteers on Saturday night dragged a large whale's carcass onto shore near Neposkiok's airport. The whale was gray, bloody, and barnacled, and the men who set to work butchering it said it was at least 37 feet long. Residents are still distributing its blubber and meat, saying it will feed families throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta for months. This concluded two exhausting days of efforts to retrieve the whale, and the way in which hunters killed it in the first place is still generating controversy. KYUK's Teresa Kostsirilis reports.
Chris Larson gave ceremonial thanks to his first whale on a black, silty beach near Neposkiok. He gave the whale water to drink, and the crowd that surrounded the carcass went quiet. Then he led the village in the Lord's Prayer. Larson is an elder and Neposkiok's honorary tribal chief, and he consulted several people from the coast for advice on the ceremony. This is the first time that anyone can remember a gray whale coming this far up the Kuskokwim River.
How long do you think the meat's going to last?
People are hungry. Maybe 2 months, I don't know.
What will you put in your hand?
About 10 men are slicing thick slabs of white blubber from the whale's back and placing them on black and blue tarps.
How are you going to prepare that, do you think?
With Crisco. I joke.
I don't even know how they prepare this. I guess we got to Google it or something.
Yeah.
A few people say they're planning to ask their aunties up the coast for advice. The elders are given meat first. People start scooping the blubber into white trash bags and fastening them onto the backs of four-wheelers. Boats of local families keep pulling up to shore. The meat is given to community members from Bethel, Akiachuk, Tuluksak, and Akiak. One woman from Neposkiok says she doesn't know half the people here. At about 9 p.m. Saturday night, Bethel Fire Chief Bill Howell arrives with his children and at least six very large knives. He also works as a local butcher. He pulls up his sleeves and begins carving up whale steaks. The whale was killed in a lengthy, brutal encounter on Thursday and pulled ashore in Neposkiok after 2 days of tedious work. Its carcass sank to the bottom of the Kuskokwim after it was killed, and Neposkiok search and rescue member Joseph Avon took the job of finding it in 30 feet of water. Search and rescue teams don't exactly have the tools for this, so Avon said he had to improvise.
Honestly, to be given this task, I'm pretty dumbfounded, you know? It's something new, and I have to think of outside the box.
The team welded massive hooks out of scrap metal, each about 4 feet long and 2 feet wide, and spent hours trawling the river with them, trying to sink the spikes into the whale's flesh and pull. On Saturday morning, they were in luck. When volunteers boated out to the whale's location, they found its carcass loose and floating on the river's surface. Six boats towed it into the shallows, and a man in a loader managed to pull it onto the shore. When the whale was first spotted 2 days earlier, on Thursday, word spread quickly up and down the river. 40 to 50 boats soon surrounded it outside of Neposkiok. Men and women in the boats were armed with guns, their grandfather's seal harpoons, and whatever they had on hand.
Well, when the whale popped up, you see a little mist. Just, I drove aggressively because, you know, I want part of that muktuk.
Hunter A participated in the hunt. Because of the potential legal ramifications, he and his friends asked to remain anonymous. They said that at one point, the whale dragged their boat. At another, they ran out of gas. Hunter B described shooting a total of 16 different guns into the whale's body, including an assault rifle, jumping from boat to boat to get a better shot.
Felt like I was covered in slime and blood, and every time I would breathe, it would just spray blood everywhere, and I mean, there was blood everywhere.
The three hunters we spoke with were devastated when the whale sank. They helped Joseph Avon recover the carcass, and they were there to help butcher it when it was brought to the shore. There was video of this hunt, and it was soon on Facebook. Some responded to it with shock.
If they don't retrieve it, it's just news that we're just malicious slaughterers.
Not every animal that comes near a village or comes up the Kuskokwim River belongs to the Kuskokwim River.
Wanton waste of the animal was widely condemned by some on a KYUK radio call-in show, but now the meat has been salvaged. The legal ramifications remain to be resolved. Julie Spiegel is a spokeswoman for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. She says that a select number of Alaskan Native villages are permitted to hunt bowhead whales.
And the harvest of other large whale species are not authorized in Alaska.
According to Spiegel, NOAA is currently reviewing pictures and video from the hunt outside of Neposkiak, and they may investigate it further. Back in Neposkiak, some of the men who are sawing their way through the whale don't want their pictures taken, and most don't want their names on the radio. Some participated in the hunt, some didn't. The local controversy and the legal questions surrounding it have both been stressful, but now, they say, this is about food.
It's given to us by God. It's given to us by our Creator. It gave itself to us.
And this ain't slaughtering animals. This,
yeah.
This is our food.
This is ours.
Okay? It's not slaughtering nothing.
As for Elder Chris Larson, he says he's proud of what Delta residents have accomplished, particularly the men who killed and salvaged the whale together.
Well, I just thanked the people that were hunting out there, and you know, I told them that they're in the good place now.
That means hunter in Yupik.
Thank you to everybody, you know, from the other communities that came and helped.
I'm Teresa Katsarilis, reporting with Anna Rose MacArthur, Christine Trudeau, and Katie Basil.
The Alaska Aerospace Corporation just completed its second missile test of the summer as part of its partnership with the U.S. Missile Defense Agency. People in the area at the time report having seen the launch overnight between Saturday and Sunday. According to an MDA press release this weekend, a U.S. Air Force C-17 air-launched a medium-range target ballistic missile over the Pacific Ocean. The release says the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense Weapon System, or THAAD system, at Narrow Cape successfully located and intercepted that test missile. As detailed in the release, the experiment was done to gather threat data from the interceptor and will help the MDA improve the THAAD system. According to the release, the MDA has completed 15 tests of the THAAD system, all of which have been successful. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the chronic problem of maintaining a police force in rural Alaska.
We haven't hit desperation mode yet, but if we don't have any officers or a new chief within a couple months, then I think we would worry.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag careersbeginhere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
A Fairbanks man is dead following a hatchet attack at a local bar there. Fairbanks police report 54-year-old Mark Allen Mitchell died this morning following the attack last night at Club Manchu. Police spokeswoman Yumi McCulloch says it was unclear what motivated the suspect, 49-year-old Brett Matthew Gilbert.
The initial investigation and video surveillance showed that without any warning or provocation inside the Club Manchu, the suspect struck the victim in the side of the neck, and he fell to the floor. The suspect continued to strike him several times in the face and neck with a hatchet.
McCulloch says the attack was halted by another person, and Gilbert fled the bar. He was later taken into custody without incident at his home and is charged with first-degree murder. She says it's unclear if there's any connection between Gilbert and Mitchell and if drugs or alcohol played a role in the attack. This is the seventh murder in Fairbanks so far this year. Sand Point is facing a problem with its police force. It doesn't have one anymore. KUCB's Barrett Wilbur reports that in rural Alaska, it's the latest incarnation of a familiar struggle.
The city of Sand Point is unexpectedly without a police force. In just 3 weeks, all of its officers resigned. City Administrator Andrew Varner says the first officer wanted to be closer to a spouse who's in the military. A week later, the next two officers, a married couple, left because of a, quote, family decision. Varner says that left Police Chief Roger Bacon, who was scheduled to vacation in Scotland, as the island's only law enforcement.
There was sort of a mutual understanding that if he left to go for a month-long journey and leave the community with no law enforcement, understood by both sides that if he came back, he would not be an employee of the city. And so within a day or two, he had turned in his resignation.
All Bacon had to say about his departure is, quote, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it, and that he was headed to Scotland. According to the city, there is a contingency plan. An Alaska state trooper will be in town next week, and Sandpoint is vetting an interim police chief. Varner acknowledges losing the entire force in such a short period might seem unimaginable to outsiders. But in Sandpoint, struggling to hire and keep officers is the norm.
Losing an officer in Sandpoint, that's certainly not new. Certainly not new in rural Alaska either, especially in law enforcement. It's kind of tough to keep officers around. Our department has been, you know, basically understaffed for years.
After spending most of last year working to fill the now vacant positions, Varner says none of the officers worked in the force longer than 6 months. Seeing every officer resign for family or travel typifies Sandpoint's challenges as an isolated town of 1,000 residents, where round-trip tickets to Anchorage alone can cost over $1,000. Varner says it's difficult to provide enough compensation and flexibility to convince non-locals to stay.
So we'll bite the bullet, metaphorically. We haven't hit desperation mode yet, but if we don't have any officers or a new chief within a couple months, then I think we would worry.
Before the resignations, Varner says police were focused on dealing with Alaska's opioid crisis and managing the seasonal population increase due to commercial fishing. In Unalaska, I'm Barrett Wilbur.
Wildfire season is holding on in Alaska as warm, dry weather persists later than normal. The Alaska Fire Service reports that water scooping planes and smoke jumpers corralled a new blaze north of Fort Yukon over the weekend. The Chauvin Lake fire was detected Saturday afternoon, burning within a mile and a half of native land allotments. The AFS says four water scoopers made drops on the fire, which was mopped up yesterday by smoke jumpers at under 4 acres. Another new blaze southeast of Fort Yukon was discovered yesterday morning. The Sucker River fire is burning in a remote area of the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge and being monitored. While Unalaska's biggest subsistence salmon run got off to a slow start this season, it's now at a sustainable level. The start of the McLeese Lake run was so low, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game issued an emergency order early this month to protect the area around the mouth of the creek. Colton Lipka is a management biologist for the South Alaska Peninsula and Aleutian Islands. While there are a lot of factors at play, he says low water could have affected the run, and they're seeing that in weirs across the region. Lipka says this is the department's final year using Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund money for the project. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is in the process of securing other funds, but if they are unsuccessful, Lipka says the weir won't operate next year. Instead, they would monitor the run through aerial surveys.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Alaska Department of Transportation is working to update the state bicycle and pedestrian plan. The Bike and Ped Plan is a policy document that guides road design and education surrounding non-motorized transportation. The plan was last updated in 1995. As part of their process, the DOT is seeking input from Alaskans about what they want to see in terms of bike and pedestrian access. Marketa Moulton is a statewide bike and ped plan coordinator. She says DOT wants input from communities of all sizes.
On the urban areas like Anchorage and Fairbanks, there's already good infrastructure there. There's, you know, roadways, there's pathways. Where the farther out in the rural areas and remote areas, you know, we're dealing with gravel roads, we're dealing with trails. So there's a lot more interaction between smaller off-road vehicles and pedestrians.
The DOT is accepting input at akbikeped.com. A beluga whale was harvested yesterday evening near Dillingham. It was the whole hunting party's first time to take a beluga. KDLG's Avery Lill has the story.
Beluga blood mixed with water on the boat ramp by the Dillingham City Dock. A crowd hovered around Cade and Daryl Woods of Dillingham and Rebecca Ozina of Little Diomede as they cut the edible skin and blubber and put it in plastic totes. Frank Woods, Cade and Daryl's father, coached them.
Just cut, Daryl, cut along the last ribbon, leave it there. Follow it along. Cut it off.
The community showed up in force when Frank Woods announced their catch on the Dillingham Trading Post Facebook page. Lines of cars brought people with their totes and trash bags. The successful hunters shared their meat with everyone who came. It took about 2 hours to process the whole animal. Cade Woods said the three were out commercial fishing for silver salmon when they noticed a pod of belugas.
We noticed one was nosing up to the beach and trying to get salmon. So we went up right to it and fired one shot, missed, and got it with the next one.
Rebecca Ozina said her family in Little Diomede, over 500 miles away, celebrated the catch with a traditional dance.
Right after we landed the beluga, I called home, and right now they have Russian relatives, and they're in Diomede right now celebrating a family reunion, and I asked them to announce it so they could celebrate for us, because usually when they land whales, they have a really big Eskimo dance celebration. Other people from different villages would come in and Eskimo dance and celebrate and feast. So I'm happy they are celebrating for us.
In Bristol Bay, an average of 23 belugas are reported harvested each year. According to the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, the population of belugas in the bay is stable, and that number is well within a sustainable harvest size. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
This spring, a controversy erupted when an extreme environmentalist launched an online attack on a teenage whaler from St. Lawrence Island. Anchorage-based writer Julia O'Malley went to the community of Gamble to hear about what happened afterwards and wrote an article about it for the magazine High Country News. The story is about 16-year-old Chris Apasangak. His bowhead whale strike was celebrated by the community, but O'Malley says when the story was reported, it generated unexpected attention online.
But what that did is took that story, which meant one thing in Gamble, and broadcast it to a wider world that didn't have the same cultural understanding of whaling. And so Paul Watson, who is a really kind of extreme environmentalist, also reality television figure, came across that story and went off to his personal social network talking about how no one should take a whale, and in profane terms, and really personally attacking Chris, the 16-year-old who got the whale.
If you would, I'd like you to read a segment from your story that captures the difference in messaging from decades ago to today.
100 years ago, even 20 years ago, when Gamble was an isolated point on the map, protected part of the year by a wall of sea ice, catching the whale would have been a dream accomplishment for a teenage hunter, a sign of Chris's passage into adulthood and a story people would tell about him until he was old. But today, in a world shrunk by social media, where fragments of stories travel like light and there is no protection from anonymous outrage, his achievement has been eclipsed by an endless wave of online harassment.
What do you think people in the lower 48 and even along the road system misunderstand about hunting in a place like Gamble?
I think people don't have the best understanding of food insecurity and, you know, how that is also a driver, a significant driver in rural communities. You have to get wild food. You cannot, in a place with a very weak cash economy, you cannot just rely on going to the grocery store. So I think there's some misunderstanding there. But hunting is an expression in Alaska Native communities that I have visited. I have found that hunting is an expression of culture. It is a conduit for the transmitting of values from one generation to another. The subsistence hunt is absolutely central to sort of how people view themselves and relationship to nature and how children are taught to understand nature. So it's so much more than just about food is and economics are a huge factor, but it's so much larger than that.
Chris's family worries about him. He's a young person at that age when your emotions can be kind of hard to control when you're a teenager. They're worried about him being a young person and being able to handle all of this negative attention that's come his way. Even though he's quite quiet, what sense did you get from him in this regard about how he's able to process or not process what's happening?
Yeah, I'm a mother of two boy children. So and it is my feeling that sometimes they process things in a way that's different than I do as a woman. And so I can imagine as a teenage boy that that's kind of, you know, overlay adolescence on all that. And it's kind of its own thing. But my feeling is that he feels best when he is outside of the village, when he is. And he spoke about that. You know, he said, I just try to forget about it. I try to go with my one friend and we go out and we go boating, or we go out and we look for birds. And I think that if, you know, who knows how things will turn out for him, but I think that the positive sort of healing influence for him is really to be out in nature where things make sense, and to be performing, you know, the hunt and feeding his people in his village, his family. You know, in a way, there I have some misgivings about, I had at the end some misgivings about doing the story. It felt important on a wider level to tell this other side. But at the same time, I don't know that it helps Chris to rehash it. I think it helps him more to be quiet and to return to sort of things that he is used to and accustomed to.
Julia O'Malley is a freelance writer based in Anchorage. Her story, The Teenage Whaler's Tale, came out in the July 24th edition of High Country News. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Emily Kwong in Sitka, Teresa Costarillas in Paskiak, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Avery Lill and Allison Mollenkamp in Dillingham, Zoe Sobel and Barrett Wilbur in Unalaska, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.